Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Phileas Club. This is episode number 34 for March 2011. And welcome to the Phileas Club, the show where we talk about the news from the past month from different points of views from around the world. And I think it's quite appropriate today, since we have people from France, the Middle East, and Asia. We are not, it's a little bit too early for the US to be awake, so it's just us. We have Turkey, as usual. How are you doing, Turkey?
I'm well, Patrick, and how are you doing?
I'm good.
Any
I'm
demonstrations excellent. In France or strikes or something?
No, not lately. You know, our dictatorship is still holding quite strong.
All right.
wow, that makes me sound completely like something I'm not. We have a returner on the show. Letad is back from Thailand. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you. So the same.
We spent about, you know, 5 minutes discussing the pronunciation of your name last time you were on, which was August, I think.
Right. Yeah, August.
So we're just going to say Letad. Is it good?
Right. Yeah, that's good. It makes me sound French.
Damn it. Okay, so thanks for being on the show again. And we have a newcomer. Kat is joining us from Japan. How's it going?
Yes, hello, I'm fine. Everything okay?
So far. So as you can hear with her lovely, lovely accent, Kat is actually French, right?
Yeah, I am. I thought I lost my accent. I'm so sorry.
It's very short. It's very small. We can barely
I'm trying
hear.
Hard. I'm trying hard, but still everybody knows I'm French. Sorry.
So you're French. Oh, I'm getting a little bit of echo from your side. Maybe you have. I don't know where it's coming from. Maybe from Turkey. Please try to turn down the volume, everyone. I don't know where it's coming from. But yeah, Kat, so you've been living in Japan for about a year, correct?
Yeah, I moved to Japan last May. So now it will be almost 1 year.
So, right. Yeah. So it's exactly the right time to be in Japan.
That was a little bit tough, but yeah, a bit surprising for French as well.
Yeah.
We never experienced that, so it's a bit complicated, a bit scary, but yeah.
Yeah, I remember I was in Japan maybe 10 years ago, and we had a few earthquakes, which was weird, but okay, you know what? Let's just get into the show right now. In France, at least, there were two topics for the whole month. It was the Middle East and Japan, of course. And I guess we're going to be talking about Japan first, and then let's go into the Middle East. But Japan, yeah. can you tell us, Kat, how things happened in Japan with the Japanese news and the Japanese people? When the earthquake, sort of tell us from that point of view on the ground, how things evolved in the first, let's say, you know, few days. You were based in Tokyo, right?
Yeah, I'm based in Tokyo. So first of all, like earthquake, we have maybe once a month a little bit of shaking. So it's not really a big thing here like we used to it. And then when the big one happened last Friday, the Friday 11th, I was in US, so I was not exactly in Tokyo when it happens. But then only people in the big towers could feel it a little bit stronger. But if you were in the street, of course, it was a bit more deep. But you cannot imagine it was so big at that time. Mm. So I was in US, and then I said, okay, so I have to come back. My only concern was, okay, could I get a flight? Because at that time, the transportation were very bad. So I went back, and I could not imagine everything is going to evolve so badly with a nuclear plant and everything. Mm.
So basically, when did you get back in Tokyo?
I got back the night between 12 and 13 of March, so very early Sunday morning.
So a couple of days, not even a couple of days after the earthquake.
Yeah, a bit more than 24 hours, and everything was pretty okay, like very quiet. I could find a transportation to go back home, so that was pretty fine. And then the whole thing with the nuclear plant came slowly.
I'm sorry, oh. Kat, just for a second, I wanna interrupt and say, for us, the reporting that was done in the days following the earthquake was that of not devastation, certainly not, because we know that the Japanese infrastructure is built for that kind of event, but it was told that people had to stay in the offices, you know, in Tokyo. They couldn't go home because there was the transportation was not working, and people were starting to stock up on food and drinks, and the vending machines were empty. You couldn't find food or drinks in the convenience stores and stuff like that. I don't know if Turkey and Letad, if it was reported in the same way, was it reported as chaos or not? And then we'll go back to Kat to hear how it actually was.
Well, on the first couple of days, it wasn't really a big chaos. And I think because even with transportation and so on, most of the reporting was more about checking and making sure everything was okay, more than that everything is broken. I think the real problem started is when people realized how bad that tsunami was. Right. And then followed by the nuclear reactor. But in the first 2 days, nobody expected this huge disaster, especially since it's Japan.
Yeah. Well, it's still an enormous earthquake. But yeah, with Japan, I guess what I should say is the general feeling was if that had happened anywhere else, the devastation would be unspeakable. But because it was Japan, it was...
Yeah, I personally think Japan was prepared for it. I really hate to see what would have happened if this happened in some other country, poor country like Indonesia.
Letad, what about Thailand? How was it reported on in the first, couple of days?
Right, so we heard about the earthquake. I mean, as soon as we heard about the tsunami, if you recall, several years back, we also faced a tsunami.
Right.
So it kind of focused on that and the devastation that it got. So so we actually didn't talk as much about the effects of the earthquakes as much as the tsunami, and we got a lot of pictures of how all the coasts were affected. And in Thailand, we don't have much of an international news network, so mainly it's from CNN and things like that. So it was mainly about all the damages, and afterwards it came to the radiation, but. I had to resort to my friends that were actually living in Japan to get more of the real reaction that was a bit more calm than what you could see in the news network.
Okay. So Kat, you land on, the morning of the 13th. So
yeah.
What's the situation then?
That was pretty normal. I mean, of course, everybody was talking about Sendai and the tsunami and the disaster, but not really about the nuclear plant. So, hello? Yeah, so of course it was pretty normal without being normal because many disasters in the north, but then I felt pretty safe when I came back. And people were stuck on Friday at work because they stopped trains. So everybody like living far away from Tokyo Center, they were stuck inside. But at that point, there was no food problem and not like that was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, the major damage were in north at that time, so...
So in Tokyo, it was just like an inconvenience because the transportation was stopped for safety reasons, but it was just life as usual.
Yeah. I mean, of course, everybody was staring at the news, and it was 24 hours on 24 on TV. Mm. And then we had a lot of aftershock, so which is pretty scary because you have the news on TV 24 hours. And when aftershock is coming, you have a small alarm on TV, and you know it's coming a few seconds after. So, yeah, it's a bit stressful. But at that time, nuclear plant was not so huge thing. I mean, at least Sunday morning, and then it came.
Right. So, okay, so can you then walk us through what happened with the, you know, the way the news ramped up and how it was reported on by, just so you know, to the listeners, we're recording this on Saturday the 26th, and at this point, it's the threat we thought had been resorbed, but now it seems that reactor number 3 has been leaking quite severely, so the concerns have come back. But yeah, so when you were there at the beginning, can you tell us how the news came out and how the TV, you know, TV reported on it? Because just go about it and you know, just talk about it, and I'll ask you more questions.
In the first few days, Japanese TV was only talking about the damages in the north. So the news came pretty slow about nuclear plants, and I had more news from internet and friends than from Japanese TV. Of course, my Japanese is not so good, so it's also a problem, but they were not communicating that much. So what happened is that French embassy published a note on the website on a Sunday, and it totally panicked all the French community. And then it started like that, and maybe Monday or Tuesday after that, Japanese TV communicated a bit more about nuclear plant and the risk. Because as well, Tuesday 15, there was the wind change from there was a leak.
Right.
Because they released hydrogen explosion, and a little bit of particles were in the air, and then the wind came Tokyo the 15th of March, Tuesday, so then they communicate a little bit more, but of course much less than foreigner TV.
You know, that's something that really was very clear from France here. There were a lot of people who were saying, I guess two different approaches. In Japan, people were saying, you French people and foreigners are sending a wave of panic for no good reason. Here, everything is fine, you know? And I heard this from several different sources of people saying, we don't understand why the foreigners are panicking about this, because here, on the ground, the situation is not a problem at all. And people are leaving there were a lot of French people that left Japan and, you know, from different countries that left Japan, not because they felt danger on the ground, but because their families were so worried that they demanded that they would come back home.
Yeah.
Is it, just before we go back to Kat on this, is that also something that you guys felt in Saudi Arabia and Thailand, or is it just France?
Saudi Arabia, I'm not really sure. It's apparently there were more important other things to worry about. So specifically that aspect of the earthquake, nobody was really looking into. It's all about the disaster and what's going on, and then everybody's worried about the Middle East. So
sure. So there weren't any, you know, Saudi in Japan that were, you know, the embassy said, you have to come back now, we're not going to...
There are a lot of Saudis there. They're not many. I think there was about scholarships, Saudis on scholarships studying in Japan. I think there's about 300 in the Tokyo area. And apparently their families were worried about them, and the Saudi embassy did...
The Saudi embassy did what? Oh, Turkey's gone. Okay, Letad, you can...
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, exactly the same. I mean, the day after everything happened, all of my friends from Japan came back. And I mean, amazingly, when they came back, they actually didn't try to follow, but they did follow what happened, but through the news. And they were still kind of afraid to go back to Japan. But I mean, once I've actually talked to people that stay there, they were pretty calm. And before we get into that, I mean, I was just kind of wondering about
sorry
how
about
Japan.
That.
Did you mute yourself, Turkey?
I automatically muted because my phone rang.
Oh, okay. Okay, keep going, Lefad.
Yeah, I was just wondering about more about the steps of how you think Japan communicated their procedures, because, I mean, what channels did they use? I mean, I got a couple of humorous examples of how they're such a cartoon or manga culture that all their communication always had like sound effects about of how to do things and what could happen and things like that. Like, for example,
there was the children's advisory video that came around.
It came about the nuclear power.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I heard my friend that they communicated that to use only they would turning off the electricity and we could only use gas and things like that. I was just wondering about how they did that. Mm.
For us it was different approaches to that issue. Kat, how was it communicated? You know, was it calm and rational for the at least in the beginning, or was it did it feel like someone, you know, the government didn't want people to panic, so they weren't actually informing people properly, or how was it perceived?
Of course, everybody was calm and quiet since the beginning. I mean, Japanese people are very quiet. And for me, what made me panic was the total absence of reaction from Japanese people. Like, nobody panicking, nobody saying anything. So finally, you're like, okay, am I the one crazy here? And family is panicking overseas. So, of course, the fact that they have absolutely no reaction made me panic and made me go a bit south on Tuesday.
So you actually left Tokyo because you didn't know what was happening.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, if I had more trust into Japanese news, I think I would have stayed, because the only thing is that you should keep confined inside your house 15, and still it was not that bad. I mean, a little bit of particle in the air, but still. But because nobody reacts, then you feel like, okay, I'm not in that mindset. Yeah. I'm French, and maybe I have to escape a bit.
Right. And so how about your Japanese friends? Did they at some point say something, or, you know, did they decide that things were actually serious, or did it stay that way for a long time? How is this? Yeah.
Everybody is more concerned by the situation in the north, which is pretty serious, so I totally understand. Then when you speak, I mean, when I spoke with my Japanese friend, they were like, okay, you cannot complain. Tokyo is not touched at all, and then we are not suffering from tsunami. So just behave and wait and see, and this is not something I can accept. So that's why I move a little bit south. Mm. So for me, this behavior was really scary.
I'm guessing there's a lot
Plus the panic overseas, of course, like my mom was crying on the phone. So I was like, okay, what do I do?
Yeah.
You don't know where is the truth. Where the truth is Japanese saying on TV, or the truth is that what you hear in Europe about it, I really don't know.
Yeah. Letad, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, she just mentioned she lived in Tokyo. I mean, there was this statistic or story that I heard, and I was just wondering, I mean, both from your actual experience living in Tokyo and during the tsunami, there was zero incidents or zero reports of goods stolen during the disaster, which for me is amazing.
There were what? Sorry, I didn't hear.
There no burglaries or thefts of people's belongings.
Because no looting.
No looting, Yeah,
that's one of the, go ahead, Kat.
No, I understood as well.
Yeah. Turkey?
My question is, how are you reacting in France, considering France is one of the few biggest countries of using nuclear power?
Yeah, that's another thing I want to get to. Just before that, though, I wanted to address the videos topic that Letad mentioned. There were a couple of videos. One of them was the children's advisory video, like to explain the situation with the leaky, well, not leaky, damaged power plant to children, where they compared the power plant to, you know, they called it, what did they call them? Something Kun, I can't remember. And they said it's got a belly ache and it's gonna poo, and if it poos then it's a big problem, but if it farts then it's okay. And I mean it everyone saw it.
Well, I did not.
You didn't? Well, it's sort of a strange, in the context of Japanese culture, I think it makes a little bit more sense, but it's also kind of interesting, an interesting way to address the problem of young children not understanding what is happening. And as ridiculous as it looks, I mean, look it up, Kat, it's really, it looks completely silly, but as ridiculous as it looks, I think it's sort of, it's a good thing that you would explain to children who don't know what's happening with all this, you know, a sort of very stylized and simplified version of that. So I don't know, I think it was interesting, but also, there was a French guy, the French are all over the news, a French guy who made a video very angry with the Japanese media for not talking about the nuclear plant and the issues there. He was showing on TV, he made it in English, but he was very angry and yelling at basically at the camera and the TV saying, look at what they're showing us now. It was the standard, you know, with talent shows where they, you know, see how many ways they can shake their boobs or something like that. And that was going on TV as the problem was unfolding. And he was very angry about this. So what you're telling us, Kat, is that there was no anger and no concern in the population. Has that changed or?
There is concern, but it's like we totally have a different behavior in that kind of situation. So, of course, there is a concern because I was in the office Tuesday 15 and I could feel that everybody is so stressed, but nobody expressed same way as we do. So they just listen to the news, they listen to what they are given, but they don't ask for more. But when you are not Japanese, you, in a way, you don't belong to this country.
Yeah.
And I don't know, you cannot have the same reaction. You trust as well your embassy and you trust the news from overseas. And of course, French, I think, were the most panicking, something like that. French were a little bit too strong.
Right.
I mean, US embassy and English embassy was a little bit on the soft side. But
I think that's a good point, because when I mentioned about a lot of my friends came back the day after, but a few stayed. I mean, the difference was the people that stayed were the people that really loved Japan. And I think it's kind of like their trust towards their country that makes them, which is different than ours. Which,
There's probably a lot of Gambaru also, which is very difficult to explain. It's a Japanese concept of let's just stick it out and be courageous and keep going and keep making efforts. And we know it's hard, but we have to stick through it, kind of. So I'm guessing a lot of people have been saying Gambaru to each other in the office and stuff like that, Kat?
Yeah, but I hate it. I mean, it's like, what? I don't want to die for nothing just because I don't know what's happening. So
yeah,
cannot accept it.
So you're back in Tokyo now, and as we've been hearing in the past day or two, the situation we thought was sort of resolved in the reactor in the plant, but in the past day or two, we've been hearing that the radioactive water and material might have been leaking into the ground, and it's a very, very big concern now. So we're sort of casually talking about it and laughing about it, almost. Well, not laughing about it, but laughing together. But the situation has become very serious at this point, and you're still in Tokyo, Kat.
Yeah, but I mean, the situation is stable since like maybe 1 week. It's not better, it's not worse. And it's still a concern. I mean, it's not getting better, I think. And we had a warning like 3 days ago, like to say the babies cannot drink tap water. So you were talking before about the shortage of food in the supermarket. Now it's really reality. Before it was not. But in Tokyo, since I came back, you cannot find a bottle of water. Milk, very rare. Fresh product, not so much. And eggs, absolutely nothing. So this is like becoming very difficult. And still, we don't know what's happening. We don't know the extent of contamination. So I don't know if I should stay a bit longer or not. Everybody seems normal here, but it's not resolved in the nuclear plant.
Because the thing that we've been hearing in the past 2 days is that I think reactor 3 has been determined to be leaking, like actually leaking. And of course, it's not immediately next to Tokyo, but that is not the situation staying stable.
Exactly. They suspect it's leaking. They haven't confirmed it yet.
Yeah.
Before now, was it normal for you to drink tap water? From the faucet? Yeah. Before the current situation?
Yeah.
I used to drink tap water all the time in Japan. It's completely drinkable.
Yeah. But when they say that, then after, what do you do? I mean, you have to cook, you have to do things with tap water, and then you cannot find water in Tokyo. So what do you do? You drink beer or whatever.
So what do you do? What actually do you do? Because if you don't have bottled water anywhere, then certainly you have to preserve the bottled water for the babies and the older people, or I don't know. But what do you do? What's happening? What's your plan for the next, let's say, week or so if bottled water becomes a problem?
Didn't they just declare that the water is now back to normal?
I mean, still a little bit higher than normal. So then, I don't know, it's a bit scary still, but I drink tap water today.
Okay.
But I don't know.
maybe you guys should help me. So the main threat from radiation right now is with the contaminated water, right?
Yeah. And also food like leaf veggie from Fukushima or like that kind
fresh
of
vegetables.
Yes, fish as well. But then I'm not so concerned about food. I mean, of course I am, but I think they check and the Japanese authorities are checking a lot. So I'm not very worried. But tap water and contamination of water, it's for me a little bit more serious. Because, of course, it's coming to your house. It's not stopped somewhere.
Yeah. Well, all these concerns are, of course, completely very legitimate, and they have made it across the world because the issues with nuclear plants are very real, and they have always been very real, but they have been brought to light even more with this event. And as Turkey was pointing out, we in France are using a lot of nuclear energy. The majority of our energy is nuclear. Yeah, Kat?
Yeah. We don't have earthquake in France.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the main difference. And the earthquake that provoked that problem was one of the biggest earthquakes we have ever seen anywhere. And in France, we don't have earthquakes, period. And by the way, if we had like an earthquake half the strength of that one, Paris would be leveled. So there wouldn't be anyone to bring electricity to. So that wouldn't necessarily be the problem. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, even though there is a little bit of a concern, it's not very serious. To answer your question, Turkey, in France, we're thinking, you know what? There is a risk. There is also a huge. There are huge disadvantages of using oil. One of which is making, you know, Turkey richer, which we don't want to do.
Oh, thank you very much. What, 110 now?
Something like that, yeah. There is a concern, but it's sort of a trade-off. And that most, you know, in 99.99% of the cases, well, you know, a nuclear plant is going to be safe and cleaner than anything else. Of course, there are issues. I don't want, you know, to pretend that like there aren't. There are risks in cases of issues of problems like these. And there are the used material that we have to dispose on, which is a huge problem. But if you compare it to all the other solutions that are viable today, then this is still, I think, in the mind of the French population, this is still an acceptable trade-off. And we don't think we're going to have an earthquake that's going to be as much of a problem. So we're not really concerned about this.
Can I ask you about that? I mean, I don't know much about the earthquakes, but is there a scientific reason why you don't think there's going to be one, or just historically you have not had
earthquakes,
so you're not too worried?
We're not on a fault line, so, you know, we're in the middle of the tectonic plagues, more or less. So it's not like we have regular earthquakes, and there haven't been earthquakes. I'm sure there are small earthquakes, you know, there are everywhere. But historically, one day, you know, there will be an earthquake that will destroy everything, maybe, you know, in within the next 100,000 years, it might happen. So, and it might happen tomorrow, it might happen in 2,000 years. We don't know, but that's one of the things. Another thing that might happen is that a giant meteorite is going to fall on Paris and destroy everything. That's also something that might happen. I guess it's on that level, not quite that level, but, you know, that kind. Oh, hello, Turkey. Your phone is ringing again. It's on that kind of level of concern, I would think. Of course, in other countries, it's different. But Letad, how is it? And I'm not even asking Turkey, because I know he's using, you know, Saudi Arabia is using oil for everything, I'm guessing. But what about you? What about Thailand?
Right. So there was a push for nuclear energy a while ago. I mean, several years ago, from the former Minister of Energy. But for the same reason, it's not implemented in other countries. Scaremongering, and people are just skeptical of if they're having problems. And I mean, basically yesterday we also, if you've heard, we just had a big earthquake in Cambodia.
Right.
I'm sorry, not Cambodia. Oh yeah, it's Cambodia. And it's reasons like that that I don't think we're ever going to get nuclear energy in Thailand, even though, I mean, with the current technology, it's probably the most viable solution for us to go forward.
Was a push, and now with the story in Japan, it's sort of no one wants to touch it anymore?
There was a push, but it's kind of like a push from, how can we say, maybe academics and people more in the know, but I mean, the public never adopted it. I mean, as soon as there was a problem in Japan, people kept saying, this is why we should never have nuclear energy in the country.
Yeah, and it makes sense. Yeah. It's not like I'm saying it's ridiculous and nuclear energy is completely safe and fine. I'm just saying, the feeling in France is that it's probably the lesser of 13 different evils. Turkey, I was joking that I'm sure you don't really care about nuclear energy, but I'm going to ask you anyway.
Are you calling us evil? Did you just call us evil?
I called everyone evil, and also your sound is super muffled. I think your mic is your clothes or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we are pursuing nuclear energy, by the way, in Saudi Arabia, and we're sticking to it, according to the last official report.
Okay. Wow, that's a surprise. So you're preparing for the future.
Yep. Well, we're waiting and seeing what's going to happen with all of this stuff. You know that UAE already signed a contract to build a gigantic nuclear plant.
Really?
Turkey, is there a reason, I mean, just to supply your own country, or are you planning to also sell that energy?
No, it's mostly for local consumption.
Okay.
Because there's a huge, Saudi Arabia is one of the fastest growing populations in the world, and they need to catch up, and the oil is not enough to supply us.
Right.
And we can't use it all, otherwise what can we sell? So.
Hey, this is a little bit off topic. I don't know if we can talk about this, but your marriage is still on tracks, right?
My marriage is still on track, May 5th, and we're still sticking to Japan honeymoon.
That is what I wanted to ask. so you're leaving for Japan, I'm guessing, you know, very soon after the wedding, and you're not reconsidering?
Up till now, no.
Okay.
We decided to continue and keep our plans as they are. I don't think the situation there is serious enough that for us to cancel a trip that we were planning for a while. So
okay, all right.
And plus, we're gonna go and support the Japanese people.
I guess they need all the support they can get at this point.
Best way of support.
Bring a bottle of water.
Bring water.
I wanted to ask you another question. So now that you mentioned Turkey's honeymoon, I mean, I had some friends that were planning a trip to Japan, and then they were like, oh, no, now I don't want to go this time. And I just asked them, why not? And you know, they stopped to think for a bit. And good question. But I mean, and then they said, they usually say, I guess the atmosphere may not be like before. I mean, the fun and vibrant Japanese community. So is that true?
I agree. In Tokyo, definitely, because most of the shop, they're closing earlier. And then most of the foreigners, they left as well. So there are much less parties and stuff. So nightlife is totally at level zero. And so the mood is not not very fun. So I agree. If you want to go to Tokyo, it's not the best time. Despite it will be like a cherry blossom in a while, in a few days. But
do people have hanami parties planned or?
Because, not yet.
Yeah, hanami is when you go out in the parks and drink and enjoy the cherry blossoms and spend the whole day. I'm just explaining to the listeners.
I think the Golden Week is gonna be decisive about how the atmosphere is.
Maybe.
All right. Any words in conclusion to that story before we move on to the Middle East?
For me, I would like to say that finally this crisis revealed a lot to me that I'm still foreigner in Japan. I'm working in a Japanese company and, in Japan, in Tokyo, many foreigners left the company. So they are called, foreigner is gaijin in Japanese. So they are now called flyjin. And when you go back to company, my company, like only Japanese people, and then the morning I came back, like Tuesday, they did not say hello to me. I mean, and it's pretty tough right now to be a foreigner in Japan.
They feel like you're not being loyal to in the time of crisis.
Yeah, you escape and you show that you were a foreigner after all. I mean, before everything else. So this is going to be okay, I think. But it's tough.
Do you know of any Japanese people that left, maybe not the country, but at least, you know, to the south of or farther away from Tokyo?
Some people, they are not from Tokyo. So, of course, if like some big company were closed after 11th of March for 1 week or a few days, so they went back to their hometown. So, of course, but if company open again, they will come even if they have to queue 5 hours to go to work. Mm. Something you can never see in France. People queuing 5 hours to go to work. I mean, in France, you would say, okay, I just don't go.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, of course, some people came back to hometown. But,
So you're saying that you're feeling a hostile sentiment towards you because you left. What about foreigners that maybe stayed and stuck it out? Are they considered, you know... Is the stain of the foreigner on them too, or the ones that stayed are considered with more, kindness?
I mean, it's case by case, but I believe like if you are a foreigner and you stayed, yeah, of course they respect you more in a way.
So I left
to south, so you know I did not fly out to France, but I moved south, so yeah. I'm a little bit escaping.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, it's a difficult situation, and I don't think anyone should judge anyone in that, you know, in that situation. And by that, I mean especially not us and the listeners. It would certainly be easy to look at that with a sort of judging eye and either judging the foreigners or the Japanese themselves. But no one knows how people are going to react in a situation like this. So please refrain from, you know, just listeners, please refrain from judging anyone in this scenario. It's just tough for everyone. All right, let's move on to the Middle East. And of course, this is the other huge story that has even started to overshadow the Japanese events in the past few days and maybe in the past week. Because when did the operation start? Was it a week ago? I believe that's that's the case, right? On the 19th? No? No one knows? Okay. Well,
in Japan, I don't know.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting to ask also if that was even talked about. But so basically, in the France pushed in the UN for, at least that's how we see it from here, France pushing in the UN for military operations in Libya to support the insurgency or the revolution, however you want to call it. And this finally happened. And so there was a task force, a military task force, headed by the US of surgical strikes on strategic positions in Libya. And that was designed to weaken the military capabilities of the forces of Colonel Gaddafi. And it was sort of a mixed bag, because at first it seemed like France had garnered the support of everyone, or at least, you know, they managed to get people to be neutral. But a few days afterwards, not only did the Arab countries express a little bit of doubt with the operations, but also it seemed like, yes, it did weaken Gaddafi's forces, but it didn't completely stop them. And the insurgents, who are, you know, people like you and me with no military training, just picking up weapons and trying to fight, are so disorganized and in such lower strength that they're not really stopping the forces of Gaddafi. So we don't really know what's going to happen there. Is that an accurate portrayal of the situation? That's the way we see it here in France. I'm going to go to Turkey first, because, you know, he's the closest to the situation.
I think the reaction is divided. The majority, I think, at the moment do support the entire reaction and the intervention at this moment. However, there is a strong minority that is definitely not so excited about it. And Gaddafi is the type of guy who's using that. What did he say? Yeah. When first he started, the revolution started, he said, "I'm fighting Al-Qaeda.
Yeah.
Help me, support me, fight Al-Qaeda," calling on the Western world. And now he's calling on Muslims, "Oh, let's fight the Crusaders."
Yeah.
So
right.
He just switches according to what he needs. And
guessing that doesn't really, you know, ring, you know, that doesn't echo with anyone. Everyone knows that, you know.
No, it does echo with some people who are who are worried, who do think. However, I would assume those are at the moment a minority. However, if a single foreign Western soldier puts a foot on Libyan ground, then that view is going to be increased dramatically.
Hmm.
So as long as they're staying in the sky, I think they will get the majority support. But as soon as they put someone on the ground, I think that majority support is going to split.
Yeah. And the U.S. has very clearly expressed that they don't want to put anyone on the ground, and they don't want even to continue leading the operations, because they were sort of put as a de facto leader because they have the most experience.
I think they just have transferred it to NATO.
To the NATO, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's a complicated situation, and people are divided. There is still there's too much anti-US sentiment, as much as there's anti-Gaddafi sentiment. So people the people who support air strikes are, if you talk to them, the majority of them would say, well, it's the lesser of two evils.
Okay. Well, that's also part of the question I wanted to ask you, and not just for Saudi Arabia, but maybe if you have your finger in the sentiment of the other Arab countries. In France, it's seen as a French initiative, now led for a brief time by the US. But in effect, I mean, a lot of people, I've heard from people that it was seen as a US initiative also. How is it seen from the Middle East? Is it a French thing? Like, is really the UN and France pushing for it? Or is it US?
This is seen as a US-British thing.
Hmm, interesting.
Although, even though I think the first strike was French and they did attack ground units, around Benghazi. However, that was so undermined and not mentioned as highly as the entire British and American strike. So,
okay, I see.
So French are seen as part of it, but I think the impression of most people is that it's led by the U.S. and Britain.
Okay.
Yeah, same here in Thailand.
Yeah, I was going to move on to Asia. Before, not just about the recent events, but can you just give us, because we've talked about this whole movement that started, you know, before Christmas from a lot of points of views, but I don't think we did Thailand or, you know, Asia in general. Can you summarize in a couple of minutes how this was seen in Thailand? It's not like you have the most, you know, super friendly government either.
Right. you mean the entire kind of the Middle East?
Yeah, yeah, the whole, situations. You know, the series of revolutions.
The series of revolutions, right? So we were kind of confused, you know, we don't know what to think because, I mean, the aftermath of all the red shirts and the yellow shirts thing is like, people realize we don't know who's good anymore. We don't have like a real champion, you know, a real leader that everybody wants. And after the series of revolution, the thing you have to understand about Thailand is we've never had a real democratic background. So, I mean, as soon as we started to see that there's so many countries had revolutions, there were a lot of people that questioning, saying, is the internet bad? I mean, is the world going to crack because people have too many voices? I mean, the people say that, and it seems a bit ignorant. It might seem a bit ignorant for some people. I mean, but the reason that a lot of Thais may say that is because...
That's interesting. You're saying that the initial reaction was, wait a second, this is this freedom of speech, I'm caricaturing here, but the freedom of speech is provoking unrest and danger? That was the initial reaction?
From a lot of sectors, people are wondering a bit about, like, they're not seeing it as a big revolution and a victory for the people, but they're just saying it's a lot of turmoil. And, I mean, is this really a good thing? I mean, are people having too much voices?
Interesting.
Because we ourselves have never had a real revolution. I mean, only once where was our government overturned. But I mean, it's not a complete revolution. But I mean, after that, basically it wasn't as covered as much as Japan. So I mean, the second step was we didn't hear much about them, the France and the UN. I mean, the second step was just the U.S. attacking Libya, and I'm talking about mainstream media. Yeah,
but so you're saying that when things first started happening in, you know, in all the different countries, in Tunisia and a little bit in Algeria and then Egypt, there was an initial burst of interest, and then it sort of died down. Even as other countries were also having revolutions, it was sort of like, yeah, okay, it's all the same. The same thing is happening. We don't really care. Until the military strikes, is that correct?
Right, exactly. And it's also because we've always the yellow shirts and the red shirts are still active, just not like dangerously active. So as soon as there's a revolution, each division will try to draw their own similarities. Like the red shirts will say, "See, everyone's asking for democracy around the world and things like that." So it would soon shift to local domestic for the parties.
So now, what's the situation with now that military operations have actually happened?
It's actually died down now that after it was only reported that the U.S. attacked Libya, and now right now, like in the last couple of days, there haven't been many reports in the local news about what happened.
Interesting.
And okay. I mean, within my own circle of friends, there would be like people would talk about was there going to be another World War III?
Wow.
Yeah. But
no, that's very interesting. Like, that's very interesting because that is something that is completely not a concern for us. I mean, it's definitely a concern because it's a war, but it's considered as very local. So it's interesting that you guys, you know, would discuss the possibility of it actually becoming a conflict.
I think it's all part of this narrative of in Thailand, what we've went through basically is last year we had the red shirts and the violence, and this year we had suddenly a monsoon that came in and made the weather actually the coldest it's been in like several years, decades actually. So the weather was very weird. We actually put on sweaters for like 2 days, and then on the third day it was hot again. And then we had an earthquake in Japan, and yesterday we had an earthquake in Thailand. So it's all part of this 2012 narrative, which I cringe every time I hear it.
I saw a comic strip that was a couple of Mayans showing each other the calendar, and one saying, "Hey, I think I'm running out of place on the calendar. It starts in 2012." And the other one was saying, like, "Yeah, that's going to be quite a kind of funny. It's going to freak people out at that point in history. It's going to be funny."
It is working here.
Yeah, okay. All right, Kat has been saying very silent and very quiet.
Yeah.
What about, can you tell us how things, because I would think that Japan is sort of part of, you know, the same circles that maybe the US, France, Germany, the UK are in. So certainly there was a little bit more concern over the revolutions in the Middle East than there was in Thailand, but maybe I'm mistaken. How was it reported on, if you think back, you know, 3 months ago?
Yeah. I mean, among the foreigner community, of course, people were discussing about it, and it was a concern for everybody, and maybe seen as a good things, like things are moving there. Of course, now since the earthquake, there is not much on it on TV about it.
Some
Japanese people are concerned and they follow it, but because of the news, I think it's a little bit stopped here. But I heard as well, like since involvement of France and the US, I heard as well same comment as in Thailand about Third World War.
Okay.
Yeah, I heard same. But recently I cannot say much.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, Patrick, I mean, you have to remember is we see it as the U.S. attacking the Middle East. So
that's very, very interesting. From here, it's really so focused on Libya. I want to keep going with this, but just to make sure I understand, Kat. In January and February, do you think it was reported on the Japanese media? And was it a topic of discussion, or was it just among the foreigners?
It was reported on Japanese TV, but not really discussed. I mean, 3 months ago. Maybe now is Libya a bit more. I mean, before earthquake. Yeah. And because within foreigner community, there are people from Israel, from Middle of East, course. From everywhere. So, of course, they discuss a bit more than Japanese people. It's a bit far, and maybe they don't feel concerned. I mean, 3 months ago.
Sure.
Yeah.
And when it was, you know, reported on, was it like the strong and proud revolution of the people is fighting against oppression? Or was it, you know, the people are unhappy for some reason and we don't really understand?
Yeah, just the fact they are unhappy for some reason, and then this is happening, but I don't feel that there was a lot of passion into the report. That was a cold one, and this is happening. Oh, okay.
I guess, it's really far away, so we'd be asking a lot. I mean,
And as well, it's really far away from a Japanese behavior, I think. So sometimes when that kind of things happen, do they really like, oh, world is crazy? I mean, that could not happen in Japan. There is a little bit of things like that.
What about during Egypt? Because I just recall that for us in Egypt, that was extensively covered.
Can you come closer to the mic, Letad?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I just recall that the Egypt revolution was actually extensively covered. I mean, the subsequent countries were not. So was that the same for Japan?
Yeah.
Is it just the news media like dying down and getting tired of the same thing?
Maybe a bit more, but I did not hear about it so much.
Well, what came out, I think, of the strikes now in Libya, I don't know how much of a role it played, but it seems like the whisperings about the reason for that is, of course, to help the Libyan people. I think we were discussing last time that if there is ever a right time to actually go into military operations, this is probably it. This is, you're never going to find a better justified reason to do it if that you know, if a justified reason for going to war exists.
Well, Patrick, if those strikes were delayed two more days, Benghazi would have fallen under Gaddafi, and he would have get controlled again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's exactly my point. And if anything, if they had happened, you know, 3 days before, the situation would be extremely different now also. One of the reasons was that people are whispering about is the fact that the U.S. didn't want that wave of revolutions to stop. And it seems reasonable, like a reasonable, you know, reason. And in my mind, it wouldn't be just the U.S. I don't think the Western world would want that movement to come to a stop, which it was being threatened by. It's hard to evaluate, but kind of threatened by it if Gaddafi had won over the insurgency. And now, in the past few days, so we've seen unrest in Yemen and other countries. And in the past few days, the most surprising thing to me, the most unbelievable development, was the fact that Syria is actually having similar trouble, very serious trouble. And they are following the exact same pattern that has happened in other countries before them. The people are unhappy. They're demonstrating, sometimes rioting, and the government at first denies that there is any problem or refuses to do anything. Then they show a gesture of goodwill, hoping to appease the anger of the people by, you know, raising salaries and stopping a state of emergency.
Canceling the state of emergency.
Right, that has been in place for decades, which was exactly what happened in the countries before Syria, and that's the point we're in now in Syria. And it seems like if what has happened in the other countries before happens there too, then of course that is not going to be enough, and. So I don't know. That's the situation we're in now, is there a feeling that maybe the revolutions are gonna get back in gear and start again in other countries? I mean, in Japan, obviously, you have other concerns. So I'm guessing you're not talking about that too much, as you were saying. But, Turkey.
I don't think there's many countries left for a revolution, at least not in the Middle East. You got the Gulf states. The Gulf states. There was an uprising in Oman, and it's now settled down. The Sultan of Oman gave them a lot of concessions, so everything is settled there. The other country you have is Bahrain. Bahrain is more of less than a revolution, more of a sectarian war. It's between the Shias and the Sunnis, and of course now the Gulf nations have interfered, and they have forces in Bahrain to protect the Sunni government. And I don't think there's much going to happen there unless Iran decides to use power against the Gulf, and which is very unlikely at the moment.
Right.
So other than that, there's not many countries left, definitely.
Syria, Yemen, Iran.
Syria,
you know?
Syria and Yemen, it's already working. Yemen, it's already happening. I'm just saying that wouldn't happen in any other place. There were attempts in Saudi Arabia for a revolution which completely, absolutely failed.
Right. I wanted to ask you about this because soon after we did the show last time, I think it was 3 weeks ago, in which you gave us an enlightening explanation about Saudi Arabia and why you thought it would not happen. We heard that there was unrest in Saudi Arabia, as you know, you predicted it didn't really lead to anything. But can you give us more detail about this?
Well, the only real unrest happened in the Shia populated areas. So it's a sectarian uprising. Mm. So it didn't have happen, and the Shias they are about 5 to 10% of Saudi population are Shias, and they're all mostly in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia. And they were brought down, and then there were calls for an uprising demonstrations in Riyadh. and the government was prepared and everything, and nothing happened. I think no more than maybe less than 100 people tried to go out to demonstrate. A friend of mine went to a major mosque where one of the demonstration gatherings was supposed to happen. And he told me, well, there were 80 people demonstrating and 100 people looking and laughing at them. So it was a complete failure. And as I said, Saudi Arabia is not... The problem is you have to figure out what kind of demonstrations are you looking at. There are two types of demonstrations that happen. Demonstrations demanding reform and demonstration demanding the overthrow of a government. And those demonstrations, for example, you have the demonstrations in Bahrain. They started in the first few days, they said, we want reform.
Right.
And I think after 1 week, they said, no, we don't want reform anymore. We demand that the government be thrown out, the entire royal family. Which is actually was a big mistake by them, which pissed off all the Gulf nations and made them interfere and move in. Right. You cannot ask for overthrowing government. And that's it. In Saudi Arabia...
Well, you cannot ask for overthrowing the government. That's what happened in the other countries, and it worked in some cases.
No, it's not exactly the same. In Libya, yes, they overthrow the government. Well, in Tunisia... And in Egypt, they did not overthrow the government. They got reform. The result was reform.
Well, you're playing on words here. I mean, effectively, the dictatorship and the whole structure of the government came down and was replaced.
No. The majority in Tunisia, if you go and look and review it, most of the people in charge are still from the old regime in Tunisia.
Well, but it's not...
If you go to Egypt... I don't care what any person tells me what happened in Egypt. Did they turned on the power, they surrendered it to the military. The military was still the one running the country, and they still run the country. I don't see, it's a face that changed. They changed the face. They did not change the entire structure, if you get my point.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from, but I think you're being a little bit... I think you're being a little bit disingenuous in your description of it and comparing it to Bahrain.
Hosni Mubarak, I'm saying they are reform. I think they called for reform. They got reform in those countries. Hmm. It was less, they wanted to overthrow the head of state. They did not want to overthrow the entire state.
Sure, but look at what happened in Tunisia. They ended up actually, you know, the people that were... that came back in power that were part of the old government provoked so much unrest again that they had to, the revolutionaries that were in the government resigned, and then the other ones had to resign too. So
but they are still there.
Well, you have a leading class, but yeah, okay. I guess you can approach the problem in two different ways, but my view is a little bit different.
If you come and you say, no, we want the entire government removed entirely, completely, want to change the entire constitution and everything, then you have a problem. My point is, at the end, is that in Saudi Arabia, nobody wants to overthrow the government, at least the majority.
Right, okay.
Definitely has no interest in overthrowing the government. The majority in Saudi Arabia, as far as I'm concerned, believe that this is the best choice they have, at least for this time in history for this country, and they don't want. There is a huge percentage of the population that do want reform in Saudi Arabia. And for them, they don't want to go through reform, and the majority of them through the ways of a revolution, because for them, they are... In general, they are enjoying their life. They're having a good life in Saudi Arabia. They don't want to start an outcry and all the problems that Tunisia had, all the problems that Egypt had, all the problems that Libya is having, and so on.
What about the women in Saudi Arabia? Do they have an opinion about, you know, reforms and...
Definitely. Women do request reform. There's a lot of, there's a huge demand for reform, and I think there might be reform coming in the near future. There are very, very tiny steps that the king has been taking up regarding reform in Saudi Arabia. There have been I wouldn't call reform. There have been recognition of some of the problems, and the king has issued a lot of the royal decrees recently that are pumping I think 500 billion reals into the economy and into the pockets of the people to improve their lifestyle and so on. There's about 30 billion reals of projects in housing, affordable housing being developed now. The entire population was given, the public sector was given 2 years' salary.
Okay, that's economy. What about, you know, freedom and liberties?
Saying, as I said, these are not exactly reforms. These are some tiny steps to help the population. And when it comes to reform, nothing seriously had happened yet. There are some tiny steps that are happening here and there. I can't judge on it until now. I'd rather wait because we're still waiting for the current ministry council. All the ministers, they expired about a month ago.
Oh.
So they have to have a new council of ministers. So we're waiting for that, the new cabinet of ministers, we're waiting for that to see what changes will happen in the ministries. It's late, but people are hoping it's late because there's going to be a major change.
Okay. So what about Syria, just to close off the topic? What's the view of Saudi Arabia on Syria and what's happening there?
Syria is... I think in general, at least in the media here, they're taking not too aggressive anti-Syrian government, but they are also still reporting what's happening there. So they're trying to stay in the middle to see how it ends. So it's kind of the U.S. reaction during Egypt and Tunisia. Come on, let's play with two sides until we see who's going to win.
Okay. I wouldn't characterize the U.S. reaction in Egypt and Tunisia like that, but okay, sure. Kat and Letad, what about, we're going to close off the topic. Is there something more that to be said about, Japan and Thailand's view of all of this, even though, you know, you have earthquakes and other problems, or should we move on?
For me, not really.
Go ahead, Kat.
Yeah, go ahead, Kat.
No. For me, not really. I mean, I say everything I wanted to say about it. And but it's interesting conversation. I see it as well in a different angle. So it's nice.
But I guess, as we were saying, Japan is definitely busy with other things.
Yeah.
So, Letad, same thing?
Yeah, for the two topics, the Middle East, I mean, I just enjoy hearing Turkey talk about it because we don't get as much information here. And I listened to the last podcast as well, and I've learned a lot.
And it's good that someone enjoys it because I can tell you, for me, it's a drag.
Yeah, I also wanted to say, I was scared of get the normal argument between Turkey and Patrick in this podcast, we just got. So now I'm happy.
All right.
But, in terms of Japan, I mean, just the general reaction from Thailand, just wanted to add is that it's more of like an admiration, and we've been seriously questioning ourselves if our country would be able to handle something like that.
Hmm. So that's, I mean, certainly there is admiration in everyone's eyes regarding Japan. I think there is also a little bit of concern that people are not, as Kat was saying very well, the foreigners would never, would demand more. Although, I'm saying the foreigners would demand more information, but at the same time, when Chernobyl happened, the French government said, well, the cloud, the nuclear, the radioactive cloud stopped at the Alps, so we're good. And, it might be true, it might not, but certainly, it's not like we rioted. I guess we did question it. We did say, wait a second, this is bullshit. What are you talking about? And the reaction doesn't seem to be the same in Japan. Japanese people seem to be accepting the whatever story is being told. It might be true, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of questioning of the stories that are being told by the government. So,
Yeah,
it's very unique Japanese characteristic.
But so you're saying that for you, Letad, for Thailand, being seen as something to look up to.
Right, right. I mean, the thing that everyone talked about was when they saw the government handing out the food provisions, everyone lined in queue. I mean, we all laugh about it. It's like, wow, Japan is so awesome. We would never be able to do that in Thailand.
Yeah, I guess that is something we can all agree about nowhere else.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe in China and even there.
I'm not sure.
No, I think in China, only if they're whipped.
Yeah, exactly. You have to have a bunch of people with rifles next to them. Yeah. Oh, that's horrible. Jeez. Okay, let's move on. Does anyone have any local stories? I mean, Japan, we've certainly talked about all of it, unless Kat has a quirky anecdote kind of story that she wants to tell us about, or, you know, from somewhere else. In France, we don't have a lot because everything has been about Japan and the Middle East, but... What about you guys? Do you have local stories about something completely different you want to tell us about, or should we close the show off?
Hey, this is a quirky story from the U.S.
Okay.
I just read.
From the U.S.? Did you move? What happened? What's this about?
No, you have to. So this 90-something woman, a guy in his 50s refused to kiss her neighbor. So she went back home, took the gun, and shot his house.
Wait. Refused to kiss her like she wanted to, like, French kiss her? Kiss her?
She wanted a kiss from him. He said no.
But just a kiss on the cheek, or?
I don't know. Okay. Anyway, so she went back, got the gun, and shot his place up.
did she actually shoot him?
No, he was safe.
Okay.
So I think that's just hilarious.
You have a very strange sense of humor, Turkey.
Dude, and she shot at his place.
Well, it's just you tell you that you should do what grandma says.
Yeah.
You know, there's a valuable lesson
you
to be
to
learned
see the
here.
Picture, her image. Dude, I wouldn't kiss her. Rather she shoots me.
Well, maybe if you knew that she was going to shoot your house, you might make an effort. All right. Excellent story. Anyone else has an interesting story to tell?
Well, on that note, okay. It was kind of like an interesting thing for us to know. So this is the first year that we've imported them, the Got Talent show. I don't know if every one of you know about it. So
the what?
Got
Sorry?
Talent. So Thailand's Got Talent. It's basically the franchise from America's Got Talent.
Wait. Thailand's Got Talent? That doesn't make
no,
any
sense. Thailand's
no.
Got Talent.
I know,
talent.
I know. I'm messing with you. Thailand's Got Talent. It's just funny. Keep going.
Yeah, you're making fun of my accent.
Good one.
Right. There was this contestant that this girl that went on stage and sang a song, right? And she looked like really pretty and beautiful.
And she was a man.
Yeah, she was a man. and she sang both the female and the male's part pretty well. And we were just like, oh, that's nice. And then like a couple of days later, I mean, the clip on YouTube got 2 million views, which is impossible because you don't get that many views from just Thai viewers. I mean, and it turns out that it got like big hits internationally. Like in England, there was one page about it in the Daily Mail. And the transsexuals and the gays in Thailand are really very normal and they're a big part of the mainstream media. And we were just like, yeah, it was just a weird reaction for us. It was like...
That's an interesting one, though, because for us, you know, it is something strange, you know, transsexual. Although, you know, some people might be very accepting and it's not a problem at all. I think to the general people, a transsexual is still something a little bit, you know, ooh, okay, that's weird.
You would be amazed how well accepted it is in Thailand. They're a big part of the media.
Hmm. Cool. That's awesome. So that story was, you know, the Thailand's Got Talent thing was just that the surprise that foreign media would be interested in something like that. It's like, wait, it's normal for us. What's the big deal?
Right, right. I mean, we see a lot of it. Even the singing in both the Thai and female voice. I mean, the male and female voice. It was just like one of those things.
Wow. Good for you. Go Thailand. And what about you, Kat? Do you have some strange, funny story, or is it like, you know, I understand if it's just earthquake all around?
Funny story, not really. I mean, I think nobody's laughing too much here. Sure. What is quite weird is, like, on TV, like, major company stopped to advertise, so you do not have any normal advertisement on TV, and everything you've got is, like, government advertisement, so with a bit, like, as you said, like, when they were explaining with cartoons about the nuclear thing to kids, then it's a little bit the same. You have, like, anime character singing and dancing in the most beautiful world, which is Japan. And it's so weird compared to situation to hear like these stupid songs and you feel like in Disneyland. So it's not really funny, but it's funny to see that on TV, like, okay.
Let me make sure I understand.
Yeah.
Actual commercials are not airing at all on TV.
No.
There's no commercial.
No.
And so what are these announcements about? Is it just people explaining stuff?
No, it's just like government advertisement, like saying you need to be kind to older people, you need to be happy in life, you need to eat five veggie per day, like that kind of stuff. Mm. But Japanese style, so like cartoon, singing and dancing, it's so weird because you have the news, and then you have a break with government advertisement, and you have the news again, and it's, for me, it's so weird. But it's not very funny, I'm sorry.
No, but it's interesting. That's the kind of thing, you know. One thing that we don't really get in other shows, you know, on TV or, you know, on traditional media is exactly that, the view from the ground with the strange report on something that we wouldn't, you know, hear about otherwise. So that's exactly the kind of information I'm very glad to get on this show. So thank you.
Yeah.
All right. You know, we should probably do a Japan special at one point, because it's definitely a very interesting culture. And I could also tell you a couple of interesting stories about what I saw when I was living there. Maybe we'll do that at one point.
Okay.
But for now, I guess the show is coming to a close. And before we actually leave you, faithful listener, I'm going to give a chance to everyone on the panel to tell us where they can be found on the internet, starting with Mr. Turkey, who is muted. Turkey? Are you there? I guess he's not. What I meant to say was, starting with Letad.
Okay. So just at Letad on Twitter would be great. L-E-R-T-A-D.
L-E-R-T-A-D on Twitter.
Yeah, so right. So if anyone ever have questions about Thailand or something like that, just ask me. I don't have many people to talk to on Twitter. It makes me sad.
Well, so Lertad, L-E-R-T-A-D, if you want to know about Thailand, Thailand's talent, or anything else.
Thailand's Thailand.
Thanks. Thanks so much for being on the show. Kat, do you have a Twitter account or something, or a website or something public you want to talk about?
I don't have a Twitter account. I have only Facebook. I have many, many, many pictures of Japan, so maybe it could be interesting for people. I don't know.
Sure. So, but is it okay for, because it's your real identity? I don't know if you want to give out your personal identity.
Yeah, maybe on demand.
Yeah. Anybody miss me?
Study. Sorry.
Well, okay. So we'll see what we'll discuss after the show and see if we want to put the link. Okay. And Turkey. So we were saying. Where it's the part of the show where we give people our links.
All right. So
where did you go, first of all? What happened? You left us.
I'm at the office. My phone rang.
Oh, damn it. Okay. Now you make me feel bad for making fun of you, because you're actually making an effort to be on the show, and it's very kind. So go ahead.
All right. So if you want to get in touch with me or follow me, I'm on Twitter. And my ID is Saudi. And if you like, you can check out my podcast. I hope to get the new episode up soon.
And it's the address is asaudilife, asaudilife.net.
Thank you so much, sir. And for me, it's patrickbeja.com. You'll find all the links to all the stuff I do there. If you enjoy this show, you might enjoy other shows on the Frog Pants Network. That's a funny name, but it's a real place. You go to frogpants.com and you'll find a bunch of other shows that I'm sure you'll like. Thanks so much for listening to the show, and we will talk to you again in a month. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.